support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on the Forum program this morning, journalist Mona El-Tahawi made a bold statement when she wrote in a 2011 cover story for Foreign Policy magazine that Middle Eastern countries hate women. El-Tahawi explores this idea in depth in her new book, Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. She joins us to share her own story of sexual assault at the hands of Egyptian riot police, why she chooses not to wear the hijab, and what life is like for women in the Middle East after the Arab Spring. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Mona El-Tahawi joins us for this morning's second Forum hour. She's an award-winning Egyptian-American feminist author and commentator who has lived in London and Saudi Arabia, but now resides in Cairo and New York City. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, and she recently published a work called Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. And we welcome you to Forum. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. Let's talk about a sexual revolution in the Middle East, because El-Sisi, now some people call him Mubarak too, has called for a reformation. But as you point out in your work, he's also approved these virginity tests. So how do we sort all this out, just beginning with your own homeland of Egypt?
Absolutely. Well, you know, just a couple of days ago as well, the International Federation for Human Rights issued a scathing report on the rise of the use of sexual violence by the Egyptian regime against its opponents. And those opponents are from all political backgrounds. And the stories are horrific. Sexual assaults against men, women, children, really awful stuff. But as you said, Michael, Sisi, Abdel Fattah Sisi, was head of military intelligence when the military sexually violated women revolutionaries through these so-called virginity tests. So the sexual revolution that I'm talking about is a revolution that recognizes we're fighting not just a regime that oppresses everybody, but we're fighting a trifecta that oppresses specifically women. And that trifecta is the state, the street, and the home.
Well, the street is where you endured an assault, and it was right off of Tahrir Square. Talk about that. That was during the essentially Arab Spring, wasn't it?
It was. And one of the things that the Arab Spring has, I actually prefer the revolutions and uprisings, because Arab Spring is so easily used against us when people start saying the Arab winter. So I'm still a revolutionary.
And they do say it very often. Yes.
Right, too often, you know. So yes, it happened on a street called Mohammed Mahmoud, very close to Tahrir Square. And one of the things that the revolution has helped us do, especially in Egypt, is to break the taboo around speaking out on sexual violence. And so it's not just me, but other people. But sadly, 12 other women experienced almost identical forms of sexual assault as I did on this street called Mohammed Mahmoud. And what happened was, it was assault from the Egyptian riot police. And at first they beat me and broke my left arm and my right hand in two places. And then they sexually assaulted me and I was detained for 12 hours. 6 hours by the Ministry of Interior and 6 hours by military intelligence, which again at the time was headed by Abdel Fattah Sisi.
And as a result, now you have red hair, you have tattoos. I mean, this was one of the things that you did to sort of, I guess, state your independence or your autonomy and so forth. What other effects, though, has it had? I mean, beyond the physical effects, did it help, if anything, solidify your feminism and your outspokenness?
Absolutely. I mean, I promised myself, because, you know, as a writer, my arms were in a cast for 3 months. And as a writer, of course, that's an almost impossible thing to have to contend with. So I promised myself that when my bones healed, I would dye my hair red as a way of saying I'm here and to celebrate survival and also to get tattoos on both my arms. So I have a tattoo of the ancient Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, and she's the goddess of retribution and sex. And for the sake of radio, I'll give you the polite version of what I think she does. First, she kicks your head in, then she beeps your brains out. And then on my other arm, I have Arabic calligraphy that represents the street. It has the name of the street where I was assaulted, because it's now an icon of the revolution, but also the word for that in Arabic means freedom, because we were freed on that street. So if I could describe what happened to me after that assault, it was basically a recognition that, as I said, that this trifecta we're fighting, the state, the street and the home, regardless of education, privilege, name, people know who I am, regardless of where we stand as women in our societies, unless we dismantle the patriarchy of that trifecta, we will never be free. Not just as women, but our whole country will not be free unless women are free.
It's a trifecta that is interrelated and in many ways almost a strange kind of symbiosis that goes on between the three of them. I'm also struck, though, by how often sexual assaults occur, not only in Egypt. I want to talk with you because you write about the general Middle Eastern countries and Arabic countries in particular, but the shame and repression that goes with or that follows. Mm-hmm. I mean, here you are boldly talking about this and your hair dyed and so forth. Mm-hmm. Usually just the opposite happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, withdrawal, shame, repression.
Right. You know, it's really important for me since for all the stops of my book tour in the US to connect what's been happening in the region to what I call a global moment for feminism, to recognize that what we're doing and speaking out against in Egypt is connected to the way that women in India for years have been speaking out against sexual violence. And we especially saw this after the Delhi gang rape. We're seeing this here in the US with these rising cases and reports on campus sexual assault. Just yesterday, I think it was, a student at Columbia University in New York carried her mattress onto the graduation stage to protest her own sexual assault. So I think it's really important to connect this global feminism that's happening and saying that women are speaking out. And in my part of the world, because I see that the spectrum of misogyny that I talk about, my part of the world lies perhaps on a different part of that spectrum of misogyny. Because, say, in this country and other parts of the world, you've had a consistent feminist movement that pushed for things like more stringent rape laws and shelters for women who suffer domestic violence, etc. So this is what I believe we're doing now in my part of the world now, in Egypt and the Middle East and North Africa, by speaking out, by saying that the shame is not mine, it belongs to the men who assaulted me. It encourages younger women and other women who perhaps don't have the privilege that I and others who speak out have, and to tell them that this is the time to speak out now because that's our revolution.
A quote from your book: "We women live in a culture fundamentally hostile to us, influenced by men's contempt." And what's striking about that and your writing is that the misogyny you speak of, or that you write of in this case, is linked to hate and contempt. There are some who would say, oh, patriarchy, it has a lot to do with wanting to control, for example, or it has more to do with maybe fear of women or sadism, you know, taken to a kind of end of the continuum there and so forth. But you say it's hatred, it's bigotry.
Mm-hmm. I say, you know, it's misogyny, which at its heart is that hatred and that
contempt. But it can be fear in many people's minds of women, too. They often interpret misogyny just semantically as being fear of women, so you show contempt for them, that sort of thing.
But yes.
You're very clear. You say hatred.
Yeah, I wanted to be really, you know, my book is based on an essay I wrote in 2012 for Foreign Policy magazine called Why Do They Hate Us? And I wanted to place that idea of hate on the table so that we can just talk about it openly. Because a lot of people do skirt around the issue. A lot of people try to excuse it in various ways. But I wanted to get to why have we seen an increase in street sexual harassment, for example. And, you know, I can clearly connect it to this need to push women out of public space because that public space is considered to be a male prerogative, essentially. And I knew that it was a provocative thing to say, and I knew that many people would be upset and try to come up with other ways of describing what was happening. But I think it's absolutely necessary, because if it's not hate, I want to know what is, because it's the opposite of love to see these horrific levels of sexual harassment. It's the opposite of love to subject our daughters at such a young age to a genital cutting that achieves nothing but to control her sexuality as she grows up. So if it's not hate, what is it, was my question.
Well, we were talking in the first part of the last hour about ISIS and the fall of Ramadi. And there, I mean, it's a different kind of hate, but those Sunni warriors, as they call themselves, those jihadis who are part of ISIS, hate Shiites, and the Shia hate the Sunni warriors, the Sunnis overall. I just wonder also, Hirsi Ali has been on the forum program, and she indeed has been speaking out in a similar way. And in the Netherlands, she was making a film with a man named Van Gogh, who I think was Van Gogh, was mm-hmm. a relative of the famous Vincent Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. And he was killed, mm-hmm. and she was under constant threat and mm-hmm. menace, moved to the United States. But how do you feel that you are now being threatened because of the speaking out?
I don't. I mean, Ayaan Hirsi Ali and I have different politics. I mean, when she came to the US, she joined the American Enterprise Institute, which is an institute that I do not identify with in the least. But when it comes to feminism and speaking out about women's rights, I think we all must. I think it's incumbent upon us wherever we come from and whatever our personal stories are. But for me personally, I mean, the assault that happened on Mohammed Mahmoud Street, I mean, I took that personally and politically, because I know from human rights activists who are friends of mine in Egypt that, and I know from the circumstances of my own detention, as I said, I was taken to the Interior Ministry and military intelligence rather than the regular jails where people were thrown in. An activist friend of mine was detained in an ordinary jail. So my human rights activist friends have told me that they think I was deliberately targeted. So in that sense, the regime does keep an eye on me, as it keeps an eye on everyone who opposes it. So that's my way of telling you that it's not just myself who's in danger. It's not just Mona that is in danger. It's anybody who opposes this current regime. And it's a regime, as we've seen from the past few days, that has been lashing out in the most irrational.
Well, Morsi was just, in fact, given the death sentence.
Absolutely. Morsi was given a death sentence. People, three men were hanged who were in detention at the time when their supposed crime was committed in North Sinai. So we're seeing a regime that is bent on inciting people and is determined to exact the most horrible kind of revenge on those of us who oppose it. So we're all in danger in Egypt, not just me. I haven't received any direct death threats, if that's what you're asking about. The only time I received a death threat, it was the one and only, was when I defended the right of the Danish newspaper to publish the cartoons of Prophet Muhammad, because I considered that a form of freedom of expression. But other than that, I have never been threatened personally with death.
It's good. But your ideas do apply to a great deal of the region, as you say. And yet there are different aspects when you look on a continuum, for example. I mean, under, for example, Saddam Hussein, things were secular and women were actually advancing. In Tunisia now, I think there's certainly much more movement where women are concerned. And then you have the extremes of Saudi Arabia, where up until recently women weren't even allowed to drive. I think that
they're
may still be the
to
case.
Drive, yeah.
Yeah. And there's all this virginity testing and the sorts of things in Egypt that you've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And how much can you separate this from Islam as opposed to culture? I mean, how much of it has to do with religion? Because cutting women's genitals has nothing to do with, that I know of, in the Quran or any of the hadith or any of the holy books. It's just something culturally that evolved.
No, absolutely. You make a great point there because, you know, in my country of birth, Egypt, we have horrific levels of female genital mutilation. Between the age of 15 to 49, or women between 15 to 49 in Egypt, 91% of them have been cut. So this is the majority of women. So clearly, it's been documented that Muslim and Christian families subject their daughters to this. So the point that I make in my book, as I look across the region, and this is the Arabic-speaking parts of the Middle East and North Africa, so I don't look at Turkey, Iran, or Israel. But when I look at the Arabic speaking countries in the Middle East and North Africa, I make the point that it's often a toxic mix of religion and culture. And when it comes to religion, it can be Islam or Christianity. So, for example, I look at the efforts of feminists in Lebanon to pass an anti-domestic violence bill. And the two groups that fought the fiercest to derail this bill were the leaders of the Christian community and the Muslim community. So you had priests and imams together successfully removing language that would criminalize marital rape.
They could only agree like that on peace.
I know, right? And together, the priests and the imams who fought this bill also made sure that language was put into the bill that basically gave a man the right to sex on demand from his wife. So this is Christians and Muslims. So it depends on how that toxic mix of religion and culture play out. I also make it very clear that it's not just political Islam that has been misogynistic towards women. It's also these so-called secular regimes. Like even under Saddam Hussein's regime, there was still misogyny in Iraq, even under the nominally secular regime of Mubarak and now under Sisi. And what those regimes often do is that they will use a very conservative interpretation of the religion to fight their conservative opponents. And who gets stuck in the middle? It's girls and women. And they will also, because of that trifecta that I mentioned, the state, the street, and the home, at the end of the day, it ends up being men's benefit that is upheld and girls and women who pay the price.
Not only men, by the way, but you write about Yemen, where child marriages are part of the culture to a great degree. And you're talking about children as young as five who are taken as brides. And essentially, it's pedophilia. There's nothing else that one could call it.
That's exactly what I say in my book. I say in the year 2015, it must be a crime to have sex with a child. And there are women in Yemen who are fighting. But unfortunately abominably, there are clerics there who abuse their position to claim that anyone who tries to fight child marriage is going against the teachings of Islam. And so what the question I ask in my book is, why do these clerics pick and teach the teachings of Islam or pick and choose the teachings of Islam that they want to promote? Whereas I know feminist scholars of Islam, like the African-American scholar Amina Wadood, whose interpretation of the religion would never allow for child marriage. So the point I make there again...
Well, they use Muhammad as a paradigm, don't they?
Exactly.
Because he had a young bride.
Well, they use him and they use the fact that he was married to a woman called Aisha. And there are different versions of the story. Some say she was 6, some say 9, some say 19. I say in the year 2015, it doesn't matter. It's a crime today. But you know what those clerics will not tell you? They will not tell you that Muhammad's first wife was a woman called Khadija, who was 15 years older than him and who was his employer and who proposed to him. So I make the point that, you know, in our region where we have such high levels of male unemployment, why aren't our clerics encouraging our young men to marry older women in the way that the Prophet did?
The Prophet also was in many ways very much on the side of women. I mean, you can find verses in the Quran that speak to that. We're talking, by the way, with Mona El-Tahawi, who's the author of Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. What about the headscarves and what about the hijabs and the burqas, and where do you come down on all of that?
Well, I used to wear a headscarf or hijab for 9 years, Michael. And I say I chose to wear it and I chose to take it off 9 years later, but it took me 8 years to take it off. And I spent a very long time thinking about this, and I haven't... My book is the first time I've written extensively about my own experience with hijab. And I'm at a position now where I consider all forms of veiling part of modesty culture. You know, here in the US, we have purity culture that encourages girls to sign away their virginity to their fathers until they get married. And I connect both those because I see both those kinds of cultures, modesty and purity, as cultures that unfairly burden girls and women. So the way that I look at veils, whether it's headscarves or covering the face, is that they're presented as a choice. But as I said, it was much easier to wear my headscarf than it was to take it off. Why? And why, if this is something that is about choice and feminism, I ask, is it only a choice that is presented to girls and women and that I feel unfairly burdens girls and women? But men are never asked to make that choice. And at the same time, because it's something that women are encouraged to do, it doesn't...
Well, Sikhs have to wear...
I'm not responsible for Sikhs.
And Jews who wear yarmulkes. I mean, you know, it depends on the religion, really.
Well, see, I do connect, though. I do connect the modesty culture of, say, ultra-Orthodox Judaism that encourages women to wear wigs and cover their hair because it's the same. Or say Catholic nuns who cover their hair. So it's this idea that there is something about women's bodies that must be covered.
There are men in Israel who will throw stones, you know, in different Orthodox sections of
exactly.
women who wear short skirts or even what they deem to be short. A lot of this seems to do with, you know, trying to keep women from sexually expressing themselves, or, I mean, women like to wear short skirts sometimes because they just think they're nice looking and attractive or fashionable. But the fact is that in many cases it's an inhibition and a desire to really quell desire, to keep it under wraps or to keep it repressed in some ways. The argument you often hear from the clerics, though, is something like this, and this goes for the Orthodox rabbis. Mm-hmm. We're doing this because we realize that men are beasts and we have to keep the men under control.
Right. Well, see, that's a really sad way of looking at men. I mean, I want to know, do men see themselves in that? I hear from so many young Egyptian men who say, I am not that man. And so I think the more that we promote something like modesty culture or purity culture, the less we require of boys and men to behave, to be decent human beings. So surely the emphasis should be on men and boys to be decent human beings and not to unfairly burden, as I said, girls and women to behave for themselves and on behalf of men and boys as well. And that's one of the things that I talk about in my book. We have to stop saying things like, don't harass a woman because she could be your mother, sister or wife, because I don't need to belong to anyone's family to deserve the respect that I should have as a human being. Instead, we should be saying every man out there who sexually harasses or assaults a woman is somebody's father, brother or husband. And we have to start putting the burden on those men to behave as decent human beings.
Or as a criminal.
Yes, is a criminal, absolutely. But a criminal that we all know. And what are we doing with that knowledge? Because something that has encouraged me lately is that I hear from, as I said, young Egyptian men, and some of them invited me to speak at a conservative town called Zagazig for a TEDx event that they had. And I went there and I spoke about feminism and I spoke about the need in Arabic to talk about crimes against women as forms of terrorism. And the students received me very warmly. And several of the young, one young man especially came up to me and said, I am so frustrated because I see my best friend harassing girls and women, and I want him to stop because it's wrong, and I want him to stop because I see how little boys look at him and think this is the way to be a man. So that's what the kind of conversation we should be encouraging among men everywhere, not just in my part of the world. What kind of man do you want, and what kind of role model are you presenting to the future men?
Well, when you see these, for example, Pew Research polls that tell you that 90% of the men in Egypt believe in genital mutilation, it's pretty disconcerting and demoralizing. It certainly must be that to you. It is to me.
Well, it's a huge fight, and non-governmental organizations have been trying to fight against genital mutilation for decades now. And I think it's very important to put the focus on men, because a lot of people will say, well, you look, it's the mothers doing it to their daughters. But, you know, women are not stupid. Women understand what their culture requires of them to survive, and what their culture requires from their daughters in order to be marriageable. And so to solve a problem like this, we have to look at it holistically. We have to bring in the fathers. We have to bring in the priests and the imams who sometimes encourage genital mutilation. We have to bring in the young men who are looking for brides, and to all of those groups, not just the mothers, tell them that you are essentially ruining, first of all, this young woman and removing a part of her body that is healthy and necessary, but also ruining their future happiness. Because what happens with these modesty and purity cultures is they put so much shame on young girls to ensure that they grow up as virgins. And then somehow they're supposed to press the on button when they get married to enjoy sex. How are you going to get over that shame overnight just by getting married? And that's part of what I speak about in my book when I talk about the sexual revolution.
Young women now who have been raped by Boko Haram, in Nigeria, and many of them are pregnant. It was certainly, like in Congo and Bosnia, being used as a political tool, and they're filled with shame. I mean, you know, they were raped against their will, obviously, and nevertheless, they feel the sense of that impurity and that shame. I mean, it's not only in Arab countries, but you get into the whole question again of something like female circumcision. It's really mutilation.
Oh, yeah. I'd never say circumcision. Yes.
That's been a euphemism for years. But the idea that somehow religious, which it's not, as I said, and you know, anybody can look this up and find support for this. It's largely cultural.
Yes.
But then you often hear Sharia, that Sharia plays a role in all this, that Islamic law plays. It can be a toxic mix of culture and religion, but where's the weight for you? I mean, you talk about Islam and you say why the Middle East needs a sexual revolution, and you talk about culture.
Yes.
More disproportionately one than the other, or are they just a toxic mix?
Well, and I talk about Islam several times as well, and I give several examples from Islamic law and the way that each country interprets Islamic law to promote what I think is a misogynistic attitude towards women. And the way out for me are groups like a movement I belong to called Musawa. Musawa is the Arabic word for equality. And this is a movement that was launched in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia in 2009 and brings together both scholars of Islam who reinterpret the religion in feminist ways, and activists and writers such as myself. Now, I consider myself a secular feminist, but there are women in that movement, like Amina Wadud, the African-American scholar I mentioned, who identify as Islamic feminists. And somebody like Amina Wadud, I mean, in 2005...
I'm sorry, we're coming up on a break. Hold that thought. Let me actually do this. Let me give the phone number and tell you, our listeners, how you can join this conversation, which we cordially invite you to do. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Music got me unawares there. I'm sorry. But feel free to join the program. Again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. You can communicate with us that way as well, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Mona El-Tahawi. She's the author of a book called Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. And we're talking about really the whole sense of really what she boldly stated back in 2011 in a cover story she alluded to earlier for Foreign Policy magazine, that Middle Eastern countries hate women. And talking about her story of sexual assault at the hands of Egyptian riot police and why she chooses not to wear a hijab and what life is like for women in the Middle East after the Arab Spring. Although I'm looking at a email here from one of our listeners. And by the way, you are certainly welcome to join us. You can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'd particularly like to hear from some people who may have some ideas, some illuminating ideas or experiences that reflect on this whole problem of misogyny for women in the Middle East, and maybe ways that you think they can be ameliorated or at least reduced or diminished. Here's Beth, who writes, last month when you were speaking with Christine Amanpour on CNN, you made an astute comment that I wish more Americans would think about, and that is the issue of Southern conservative far-right Christians here in the States who have many of the same beliefs about women as the men in your book do. And you kind of alluded to that before. So you are looking at this from a more global perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, I often say that in the Middle East and North Africa, I fight the Muslim Brotherhood, and here in the U.S., I fight the Christian Brotherhood, because I consider what the Christian right-wing is doing to be a form of politicized religion. And when you look at the way that they have eroded women's reproductive rights in the southern states, when you look at something like the case in Indiana of the woman called Purvi Patel, who was sentenced to 20 years in jail for the crime of feticide, which is a crime that essentially recognizes women as moving incubators, you have to wonder what is happening to feminism in this country. And you have to wonder about the role that the religious right wing, as I said, what I call the Christian Brotherhood, are playing in fighting a feminism that women for decades fought to give women equal rights. Because at the end of the day, that's what feminism is, equality. But if you're looking at these groups that promote that have basically shut down abortion clinics and reproductive rights access to women in the southern states, you have to ask, what is there complacency? And why is this complacency allowing these religious groups to operate in ways that I would fight no matter where they were?
Well, here's a listener who's very critical, and let me read this and get your response. This listener writes, Miss Al-Tahawi is a self-serving woman who uses the American media to write books and make money. Lots of her writing is false and disinformation to defame the good people of the Middle East. Her generalizations of all countries in the Middle East is out of order. There is no way people in Egypt or Lebanon can be equal to those in Saudi Arabia. Miss Al-Tahawi is propagating misinformation and distortions to create hate and dislike of people in the Middle East. And according to Miss Al-Tahawi's close friend, I don't know who that is because it's not mentioned, her story of being raped is false and fabricated.
First of all, I've never said I was raped. I said I was sexually assaulted. But does this person give a name?
Just a listener.
See, it's very interesting. It's very interesting to be attacked by someone who's anonymous and lives in San Francisco, whereas I write under my name and I live in Cairo.
They may live not in San Francisco. We're heard all over.
Oh, is this email?
This is an email.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it was someone who called in from San Francisco.
It's an email.
Regardless, my point remains that I write under my name. I very clearly state the sources from where I got the statistics that I use. I very clearly state that the World Bank has something called the Global Gender Index Gap that places the countries in the region at the bottom.
But there are differences. I was thinking about Wahhabism and Salafism, for example, in Saudi Arabia as opposed to Egypt.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is no part in my book, and you've read it, Michael, in which I've said the countries are all the same. No countries are all the same. What I do is I look at the countries and see how that toxic mix of religion and culture plays out. But at the end of the day, everything I say in my book can be verified. This is not something that I have invented. I am not a fiction writer. I'm proud of this book that I've written. And I also want to remind your listener or whoever this person was that I'm a product of that culture and religion. And I find it very interesting when people try to defend that culture and religion against me, a woman culture and religion produced. So I welcome disagreement. I don't think everybody should agree with what I say and what I write. But to be accused of falsehood, I think that is just utterly ridiculous because everything I say in the book can be verified.
Here's another caller joining us. Abe, John, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Eid, Michael.
Yes, welcome.
I really can't believe this woman at all. I don't know what her agenda is. It is not at all Egypt. I live in Egypt from went to college in the 60s. Cairo was one of the most beautiful cities in the world. The nightlife in Cairo was far better than San Francisco when I came there here in 1965. Women in my physics classes had miniskirt. Nobody had covered their heads. Women were free. Through the thousands of years of Egyptian history, you had women have more rights anywhere in the world. In 1919, Egyptian women threw out the British out of Cairo and let the government fell down. Egyptian women, and have three sisters, all of them are college educated. They would no way they would identify in any way with this woman. She has an agenda. She is hateful. Maybe she worked for the American Enterprise Institute. Whatever her books, I would recommend her. Anybody, please don't buy this book from this lady. She is awful. She does not represent Egypt, the great country of Egypt. Ask her if she knows thing about Samira Moussa, a physicist. She came to the United States in 1950, and she was the only foreign woman. She had visited Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, and she was murdered because she refused to stay in the United States, and she contributed to the enriching uranium. So they killed her on the way back because she did not want to stay in the United States. We were like, Samira Moussa is what we need.
All right, we're getting off the subject here a little bit, but more criticism and can I get some response, please?
Oh, I would love to respond to that. First of all, you clearly haven't read my book, so perhaps you should read it and then throw it away or give it to somebody else. But I encourage you to read it because I actually give a long history of feminism in Egypt. And I mention many Egyptian women who guaranteed political rights all the way to Hoda Sharawi, who threw off her face veil in 1924, to Duraya Shafiq, who stormed the Egyptian parliament with 1,500 women, to modern-day feminists. So clearly, I am very well aware, much more than you, of the feminist movement in the Middle East and North Africa that began in Egypt. And secondly, I don't see what nightlife in Cairo in 1965 has to do with misogyny and discrimination against women in 2015. I live in Cairo. I'm writing about the reality of women. My parents both have PhDs. My mother has a PhD in medicine. That does not mean that the Egyptian law discriminates against her. That does not protect her from the fact that when she lived in Saudi Arabia, she couldn't drive a car. So yes, we're educated. Yes, we're at universities. But why 30 or 40 years ago were all your classmates not wearing headscarves? And now 90% of Egyptian women are covered in one form of veil or another. These are questions that you clearly do not want to confront because you're a man and you have what is called male privilege. I am a woman, and the women that I know struggle with all of those things that I've written in the book. So I encourage you to read my book before you make these absolutely wild and false claims.
It's ironic to me as a reader of your book that you became radicalized in, of all places, Saudi Arabia. You found books by bell hooks and Audre Lorde and writers like that. You would think of Saudi Arabia almost as putting books like that on what used to be a papal index. You know, you couldn't read any book that went against what was Roman Catholicism.
Well, I said I became a feminist. I've written in my book I became a feminist at the age of 19 because I found feminist journals on the bookshelves. I didn't have bell hooks or Audre Lorde in at the library, but I had other feminists, specifically feminists of Middle Eastern descent.
Well, this, in view of a minaret, becomes a very important book for you. I think it's first book you
absolutely
mentioned.
Yeah, and that's written by the Egyptian writer Alifa Rifat. But to find those feminist journals on the bookshelves of my university in Saudi Arabia, those were basically the ammunitions and the weapons that I used in my feminist fight. So thanks to whatever dissident professor or librarian put those books and journals there, it helped me become the woman that I became. But you're talking about a country that essentially treats women like children for their entire lives because of this guardianship system. So I became a feminist as a way to protect myself against the misogyny I saw around me. And I mention in my book these incredibly courageous Saudi feminists today, like Wajiha al-Huwaidar and Manal al-Sharif, who have encouraged women to basically engage in the most beautiful non-violent forms of civil disobedience, which in this country everyone knows how important civil disobedience is.
And yeah, we've got Charles Murray we had on the other day saying civil disobedience should be, and he is with the American Enterprise Institute, I should mention, you are not.
No.
but he's been advocating that that people form civil disobedient actions against the kind of rules that are embedded in agencies like the EPA and so forth.
It's
a very radical
That's not a civil
view.
Disobedience that I'm talking about.
No,
I'm talking about Saudi women breaking the ban on their ability to drive in Saudi Arabia. So this is a country where women are treated like children, and yet I found these feminist journals in the on the bookshelves of my university, thank goodness.
Let me go to another caller, and that's Bert. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I've been listening, and I just want to mention I had always heard of the term female circumcision, and it just sounded very strange to me. And then a few months ago, I picked up the book Infidel by Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and she It's an incredible book, and you really learn what that's like to go through the mutilation in her life. And I don't know if you've heard of her. She wound up in the Dutch.
We just referenced her. You may have tuned in later.
I'm sorry. No, that's okay.
And she has been on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I believe she got turned down at Brandeis from trying to speak there.
I believe that's correct, yeah. But she was in the Dutch legislature, like you've said, and she certainly taught in other places throughout the United States. She's also the wife of Neil Ferguson, a well-known Harvard conservative.
Well, I strongly recommend the book, Infidel.
Okay, and we thank you for the call. And here's the listener, Shannon, who writes, did Mona hear about the recent shooting murder of Sabeen Mahmood in Karachi, Pakistan? That was a Pakistan human rights activist and NGO worker, founder of The Second Floor. Shannon goes on to say, if so, could she comment on any connection she sees between persecution of minority communities in the Middle East and that of women?
Absolutely. I mean, Pakistan obviously is not in the Middle East, but I heard about this awful murder, and many of my Pakistani friends who knew her were mourning very openly on social media. I think, it does become quite dangerous for several activists to talk about minorities in general. And if I take the conversation about minorities to the Middle East and North Africa, I think where our challenge lies is in defending not just religious minorities, but to connect it to what my book is saying as well, we need to challenge sexual minorities. We need to uphold the rights of people, of consenting adults, to love and have sex with whomever they want. So, and what one thing that we've been seeing in Egypt under Sisi's regime is a witch hunt against gay men. And if you look across the region, a lot of people cannot openly express their sexuality. I mean, women are, you know, for women to express sexuality is incredibly dangerous. So you can imagine how that also translates into your sexual orientation. But at the end of the day, the enemy is the same, and it's patriarchy. So whether we're talking about feminism or sexual minorities or people who are trying to affirm an independent existence, again, it's that trifecta that I speak about, the state, the street, and the home. And in order for a political revolution that is just against the regime to succeed, we have to have that social sexual revolution that gives everybody the right to be free and an individual in their own right.
I was talking before about the internecine hatred between Shia and Sunni, but also you have killing of Kurds because they're a minority, killing of Yazidis because they're a minority. I mean, throughout the Middle East, there's that kind of, and not just with ISIS, but now largely perhaps with ISIS. Here's a tweet from a listener named Kiki who says, I couldn't agree more with your guest. Modesty is always expected of girls and young women, no equivalent for boys or men. And Ben writes, are there any countries in the Middle East that focus positively on women's education? And does your guest agree that is where the revolution needs to begin, namely the classroom?
Well, many countries in the region have made great strides when it comes to education. If you look at the countries in the Gulf region, for example, there are more women on university campuses than men, which is a great achievement, obviously. But my question then becomes, what happens when those women graduate? So you can get a great education, but if you don't have an equal chance after you graduate as your male colleagues did, then, you know, that education ends up being something that haunts you. So when you look at the statistics that come out of Saudi Arabia, for example, where, again, women outnumber men on campuses, women's ability to work in whatever field they want diminishes greatly. And a lot of Saudi women end up having to go to Dubai or other countries if they want to pursue fields that are not open to them. So education absolutely is important. But my other question about education is how much of an influence do various regimes and religious groups have on curricula? Because if I'm going to wait for a curriculum that encourages equality, encourages gender equality, I'm going to wait for a long time, because curricula take a long time to write. And, you know, those 12 years of education are a long road. And I encourage, absolutely, education is essential. But I think it's something we need to start now and not wait until, you know, kids finish the 12th grade and then think about university education. I think it has to be holistic by focusing on that trifecta, as I mentioned, the state, the street, and the home.
Listen, King Abdullah, you mentioned Saudi Arabia again, one who was supposedly a reformer or characterized himself even as a reformer where women are concerned.
You know, I cringe when I hear of any dictator considered a reformer. And you know, in the case of King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia, he was called a reformer because when he was compared to others in that country, he was considered a reformer. But, you know, that's not a good spectrum to be on. So, and you know, if he was such a reformer before he died, he didn't achieve a lot for Saudi women, because the Saudi regime has created a system by which the clerics there basically run kind of the hearts and mind of the country in return for the Saudis doing whatever, the Saudi royal family doing whatever it wants with its oil and buying all the weapons of its Western allies, be it from the US or its European allies. And so he was held back, even if he claimed to support women's rights, because women did not get the right to drive under King Abdullah's reign. Women did not get the right to vote, even though men finally got the right to vote in one of the municipal elections in Saudi. So when I look at King Abdullah's record, I don't see he achieved much for women, to be honest.
Again, our guest is Mona Altahawy, and her book is Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. We'll go to more of your calls, and let's go to Deborah. Deborah, welcome.
Hi. I want to say thanks for your clarity and strength. And my question for you is, how is feminists here, you know, women and men, we can support this conversation? It's always so challenging, this conundrum of being an outsider and wanting to support women, especially who are giving voice to this, while not seeming to disrespect women in a culture that we're not from, who have made choices to wear hijab or, you know, who are part of this old tradition. And so I wondered what you can ask of us.
Right. Thank you for your question. And I appreciate your sensitivity. It is, you know, very, very troublesome water to kind of wade into. And whenever I'm asked, how can I help you or the women from your part of the world, I always say, don't. I think the best way that you can help us is to help your own communities, to find ways here in the US where you can help the feminist message, essentially. Because as I said earlier, in some causes, there is a great deal of complacency that has allowed people like what I call the Christian Brotherhood to make these great inroads in fighting against reproductive rights and feminism in the southern states. You know, one thing that is especially disturbing in the US these days is the high levels of sexual assault on campus. I think it's an estimated 25% of young women across campuses in the US report experiencing one form or another of sexual assault. So I think there's a lot to do here in this country, because the way that when you help feminism here, you help feminism everywhere, because then men in other parts of the world can't turn to any other country and say, do you know how bad it is there? But as an American citizen, and I speak here as an Egyptian American, what you can do is point out the hypocrisy of the U.S. administration by having allies like the Saudis, for example. The U.S. Mm-hmm. buys oil from the Saudis and then sells the Saudis billions of dollars of weapons and says nothing about what I call gender apartheid in Saudi Arabia. Now, the country, South Africa, was rightfully marginalized and ostracized for its racial apartheid. We have a country called Saudi Arabia that practices gender apartheid by oppressing 50% of its population. Yet the U.S. administration knows this and does nothing. U.S. secretaries of state visit Saudi Arabia and say nothing, all because of oil and weapons.
Well, we have presidents like President Bush who walked hand in hand with the foreign
exactly.
minister of Saudi Arabia. But here's an email, and listener writes, since when is Forum in the business of confronting guests about the veracity of their claims of sexual assault? That was off the wall and very disappointing. Let me just tell that listener. It was a listener who made that comment. Forum did not make the allegation. But tied to that is another listener comment that says, it's interesting that the criticism of Ms. Altahawy is coming from men who would not have the same experience of Middle Eastern society that women would have. Well, I don't know that that allegation about your stating falsely having been raped, which you have never stated, been mm-hmm. raped one way or another. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it came from a man or a woman. I should mm-hmm. say that in all fairness. It was just a over-the-transom email. But most of your criticism does come from men.
And that's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting that men feel that, you know, that wonderful term mansplaining, that comes up again and again, whether it's men of my own cultural and religious background who take it upon themselves to basically try to convince me that I'm not experiencing the misogyny that I clearly have experienced. Or, you know, when I spoke in D.C., about 10 days ago at Politics and Prose, a wonderful independent bookstore. And I got great questions. And then one man got up and he actually made this wild allegation that Islam is the only culture that kills women, and that he was disappointed that, unlike Ayan Hirsi Ali, I had not left Islam. So he was a man who was not from my cultural or faith background, again, mansplaining my experience to me. So I think it's very interesting when men take it upon themselves to explain to a woman that what she's experienced so far is wrong and that they can put her right.
Well, here's another listener, a woman named Mary, who writes, why are these listeners attacking you so viciously? You're obviously knowledgeable, brave, trustworthy. What is their agenda? Why are they so viciously attacking you? Thank you for your wonderful insights and great work.
Thank you.
And another listener writes, I'm listening now and I find the guest to be a breath of fresh air. Please continue your work because I want my daughter to live in a world where she is equal. The Christian Brotherhood that the guest speaks of is as much a threat to U.S. women as the Muslim Brotherhood is to Egyptian women. I can't wait to read the book.
Thank you.
Although in all reasonable assessments, we have strong laws in this land that do protect genders from protect people from gender discrimination in ways that many of these Middle Eastern countries you write of can't even conceive of.
Well, the question is why and how did you get those laws? And you got those laws thanks to the determined effort of feminist groups over the decades. When you look at second wave feminism in the 70s, for example, it was instrumental in putting laws against domestic violence. It was instrumental in helping women make it through the court system. And to this day, women still get asked, what were you wearing? What time was it? Were you drinking? All that stuff. So it's feminism that is essentially the equality of the genders.
Feminism, which I must say had many of us from the other gender walking by their side and certainly supporting and moving along to try to make those changes. But we're getting a lot of support for you, particularly from your sisters, from women.
I'm very glad to see that. But, you know, I also have to mention, Michael, as I met those young men who invited me to speak at their university, that is exactly the kind of support that you're talking about, because these are young Egyptian men who want a different kind of Egypt. And the one who invited me, he's a 19-year-old pharmacy student, said, my community needs a feminist like you to shake it up. So absolutely, we need men as allies, for sure.
Susanna writes, thank you, Mona El-Tahawi, for being a role model for educated, conscious, and empowered women and men the world over. Thank you for sharing your experiences and your insights. And just a reminder that Mona El-Tahawi's book, once again, is called Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. You're listening to Forum, and we are talking with Mona El-Tahawi. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we're going to go to another caller here. Mustafa joins us. Mustafa, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. First, I would like to thank the speaker today, and I would like to point out to our listeners that it takes a lot of guts for a person like her to put her neck out there for the rest of the women in the Middle East. And I grew up in a country, a Muslim country as well. And I want to just... The caller who called before and he condemned her, I want to say shame on him for a couple of reasons. One, I grew up where my mom was liberated and my sister is suffocated. And these are two different generations within 20 years when my mom had to go to school in like any form of way of hair, of dress of that she wants. Her pictures in the 70s were showing no difference between a girl in Paris or a girl in San Francisco. And today, my sister back home is fully, like, she's not fully into this, but she's pressured to put a veil or hijab because of the school social pressure on her. And I found that very unfair, extremely sexist, And I am here to say, as a man from the Middle East, we cannot move forward. We can never solve any issue that we have unless we solve the issue of women. Thank you.
Mustafa, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much, Mustafa. That means a lot.
And Ben writes, how come feminists don't push for female supremacy instead of equality? Men have messed things up for thousands of years. Why not let women control things? We'll bring some more callers in here, and we'll go to Oakland next. Miriam, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, and assalamu alaikum, Mona.
Alaikum assalam.
I just want to tell you I grew up in a home with a Christian mother and a Muslim father, and not only did they give me freedom of choice in religion, which I found with most of my sisters in this film, you know, very grateful for my father to give me that choice to choose Islam or Christianity. And because of that, I chose Islam because of, you know, he was living his religion, you know, through actions. And he's never made me wear a headscarf. He actually encouraged me not to wear one because he wants to promote equality. And he's from Baghdad, and he left Iraq in the 70s. And that's basically it. I wanted to thank you so much, and that there is fathers out there encouraging their daughters to be equal as men.
Miriam, thank you for that call.
Can I respond really quickly,
please,
Michael? Thank you very much for that, Miriam. I really appreciate it. And absolutely, you know, when I look at my parents, I grew up in a home that was feminist and egalitarian from the beginning. My parents met in medical school, and thanks to a grant from the Egyptian government, they both moved to London at the same time to get a PhD in medicine. And the message that I got from both my parents was education and knowledge were the most important things. So it's so important to focus on the girls and women, and absolutely to encourage fathers to not get in the way of their daughters, to leave their daughters to be as free as they want. So
for a while, your mother was a breadwinner, right?
That's right. For our last year in the United Kingdom, both my parents had a PhD, but my father couldn't find a job during that last year in the UK. And he would come and pick us up from school. He would have dinner ready home for my mum, who would then come back from the hospital and we would eat. So, you know, I've grown up, as I said, in a very feminist home. But at the same time, because I recognize that that is privilege. I recognize that not every girl and woman in my part of the world has that privilege. And so it's incumbent upon us, those who have that privilege, to speak out as loudly as we can so that more sisters in the region have that liberation and that freedom to choose.
Let me read another email from Sam, who writes, "This woman makes much more sense to me than Ayaan Hirsi Ali. The notion of a reformation in the Islamic world that Ms. Ali suggests shows zero comprehension about the fundamentalism, anti-Semitism, and class violence of the Reformation. Al-Qaeda are the reformationists, the inheritors of Wahhab, who want to purify the corrupt Islam of the Ottomans. Keep fighting for women."
Thank you.
Let me get another caller on here, and that's Jim from Santa Rosa. Hi, Jim.
Yes, first of all, what courage, what inspiration that you've done to stand up against patriarchy, which we're all victims of. I think these guys who are criticizing you do not understand that they're also victims of a policy of a millennially old attitude against women, that, and we're tethered to the Middle East through energy, so we're caught up in this passion play of misogyny. So thank you for that. I had a question, an idea. It's kind of sarcastic, but what do you think? What about a female underground railroad for those who don't want to be mutilated, who don't want to live under the system, who don't want a burqa? I'll take my question off the air.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. I love that question because one of my personal heroes is Harriet Tubman, who you will know, I'm sure, had the Underground Railroad, and it's a dream of mine to establish that kind of railroad.
And I hope she's going to be on the $20 bill. That may, in fact, be... Not that I have anything against Andrew Jackson. Well, there are reasons with the Native Americans to have things against Andrew Jackson. But thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time with us, Mona El-Tahawi.
Thank you, Michael.
Her book, again, is Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. And we are here with you Monday through Friday with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.